540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The Israeli military intercepts another barrage of rockets fired by Hamas militants from the Gaza Strip. And Israel continues to bomb Gaza after the large-scale surprise attack by Hamas militants. At least 1,800 people on both sides have been killed, President Biden saying today.
Like every nation in the world, Israel has the right to respond, indeed has a duty to respond to these vicious attacks.
At least 14 Americans are among the dead, and CBS's Imtiaz Taieb reports.
Tonight, another 20 or more Americans are still missing as Israel's military begins distributing thousands of weapons to volunteer defense teams in towns and cities all over the country.
Access to food and other supplies to millions in Gaza have been cut off by Israel, and international organizations are calling on Israel to allow a humanitarian corridor into the enclave. Here in the U.S., supporters and opponents of Israel's government have held protests nationwide, including at Cambridge City Hall today.
I'm a Jew, and I'm ashamed that the Israeli government is conducting these policies in my name.
The National Hurricane Center calls Hurricane Lydia extremely dangerous. It has made landfall near Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, as a Category 4 hurricane with 140-mile-per-hour winds, and is moving to the south of the resort city, which could cushion the blow. And a magnitude 6.3 earthquake has been reported in the northwestern Afghanistan region. Federal prosecutors file a new indictment against Republican Congressman George Santos of New York. It alleges Santos stole the identities of donors to his campaign and then used their credit cards to ring up tens of thousands of dollars in unauthorized charges. Reporters tried asking the congressman about today's superseding indictment.
Why should you be able to vote in the speaker's election, such a key election, when you've been charged with all these crimes?
The 23-count indictment replaces one filed earlier against Santos, charging him with embezzling money from his campaign and lying to Congress about his wealth, among other offenses. An Olympic champion is fighting for her life, so says her daughter, who's asking for money to help her fight. CBS's Matt Piper has the story.
Since winning gold at the 1984 Olympics, Mary Lou Retton has been a USA Gymnastics national treasure. Now, her daughter McKenna writes on a fundraising website that the 55-year-old is fighting for her life. The Post says Retton is battling a rare form of pneumonia and has been in the ICU for more than a week and has not been able to breathe on her own. McKenna says her mother does not have health insurance and is looking to raise money for her hospital bills while also asking for prayers.
Stocks ended higher on Wall Street. The Dow closed up 135 points. This is CBS News.
You need to hire? Indeed is with you every step of the way, helping you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. The process of moving 50 million gallons of water across Waukesha is expected to take about a week. Most people in the city should see the switch to Lake Michigan water within 5 to 6 days, although those residing in dead ends and cul-de-sacs may see a slightly longer wait. The $286 million project was aimed at addressing high radium levels in groundwater. A former Wisconsin Supreme Court justice is advising against impeaching Janet Protasiewicz, emphasizing that impeachment should only be considered in cases involving criminal activities or corrupt conduct. David Prosser is one of three former justices guiding Assembly Speaker Robin Vaughz on the possibility of impeaching Protasiewicz, who recently announced she will not recuse herself from an upcoming case related to Wisconsin's legislative maps. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Haller House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear, and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people, no machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, still no speaker. And again, I'm still pulling for Donald Trump. I'll be honest. I'm still hoping that they pull the Trump out of the bag and make Trump, even if it's just for 90 days. And I hope, you know, Marjorie Three Names gets her wish, that it's a MAGA rally every day. Because I think the American people need to see this on display. I think it'd be good for the country. I think it would be cathartic. I think it would make us... I hope it would scare the hell out of people and make us go, hey, this is not good. This is bad. But we're going to get stuck with the second tier, either Jim Jordan or Steve Scalise, or maybe someone who hasn't appeared just yet in here to help us work through who may be speaker, if we ever get one, if there is someone who actually wants it. So I've asked our good friend, former Illinois Congressman Joe Walsh, to come share some thoughts with us. He is also the host of the White Flag with Joe Walsh podcast, one of the great podcasts out there. Joe, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, I love being on your radio show.
As you should, because the reality is...
Even though, by the way, even though you piss me off sometimes, but go ahead.
Well, better off than on. So here's the thing. And then, look, you have very few places where people who disagree have a civil, reasonable, actual conversation. Are we going to get a speaker? Is this going to happen? Will eventually there be someone dumb enough to go, yeah, I want it?
Yeah, because there has to be. I don't think we'll get one right away. I don't think we'll get one in the next couple days. Look, Rick, my former political party, really last week, my former political party screamed to the American people that they are incapable of governing. Please put the Democrats in control of the House. I think that's what they did. Yep. And I think last week gave the Democrats control of the House. I don't think it matters who the next speaker is.
No. And I think this week they're just hammering those nails in the coffin, because, look, you've got what's going on over in Israel. The president said, hey, we need to send money over there. There's no money to be sent because, Congress has got to, has got to be the one that the House is where this spending has to emanate from. And without a functional House, I don't know how we're getting it over there.
That's right. Nothing can happen when it comes to money out of Congress without the House. And the House can't do anything, Rick, until or unless they have a speaker. I don't think Republicans want to show an ugly public fight this week. I've been told by some of my former colleagues that they have to bang this out in private. And when they take it to the floor, they'll take it knowing that somebody has the votes, because they don't want to go through, Rick, what they went through in this past January with McCarthy.
Yeah. And whoever eventually gets it has to get rid of that rule that one person can oust them.
I disagree. And you know what? And I think a lot, I know you know this. I bet a lot of your listeners don't. That rule has been in place since our founding for most of our history. Nancy Pelosi, who I like, changed it, but it's the people's house. And I think any member of Congress should have a right to make that motion, and then the House should vote. That's not the problem. To me, the problem is, I got to watch my language. To me, the problem is a jackass like Matt Gaetz, who puts his own interest ahead of the interest of the House.
Yeah, so good. You watched your language. You swore in.
I watched my language. I watched it very carefully.
Right as it shot out your mouth. Okay, I can understand that. You know, but at the end of the day, if you're a speaker, you got to have some. If you're going to put yourself through all this, you got to have some assertion that, you know, that you're going to be able to finish the tenure, and at the end of it, you know, you're going to be able to. Then you can throw the bum out. You're not going to have to be looking over your shoulder after every single decision you make throughout the term, though. No.
Well, but that's what's interesting, Rick. Remember that rule's been with us for most of our country's history. The one member can move. And I think a lot of people don't realize that even though the majority picks the speaker is the speaker of the whole House.
Right.
So a Democrat could have moved on a vote to vacate Kevin McCarthy. But that aside, I think the Republicans privately are going to struggle. I don't think right now Jim Jordan or Steve Scalise, who I served with, I don't think either of them are close to getting the votes now. And if they can't over the next day or two, I think you'll see maybe a consensus candidate.
Yeah. So who's that going to be? Because I don't think either one of them are going to be. And look, I've had conversations recently with some folks who no, it's going to be you know, Scalise, or it's going to be Jordan. It's going to be one of them. And I'm going, I don't know. I think they're too extreme. I think they got too much baggage. I mean, Scalise, you know, this whole idea, and I don't even know what this means. The statement that's been attributed to him is he's David Duke without the baggage. I don't know what that means. Does it mean he's racist? I don't know, but he doesn't, you know, have the hood. I'm not sure, but that's attributed to him. And then all the Jim Jordan stuff with the stuff at Ohio State. I don't know why you'd even put yourself in the run with this, knowing that stuff's hanging over you.
Remember, Rick, and you said something interesting. You said both Jordan and Scalise are too extreme. Huh? In this party, they are the party. Like, we forget that this is a MAGA party. And as far as the Republican Party, ever since Donald Trump, no personal baggage or scandals matter. Not for these Republican voters. I think they're too closely aligned that they're both going to get a bunch of votes, but not close. And so, again, I don't think Republicans want to carry this beyond this week because they look horrible. So I can then see them grabbing somebody else. Because, Rick, I don't think Matt Gaetz and the other seven care who the next speaker is. They just wanted McCarthy's scalp.
Yeah, they just most certainly wanted that head on the wall. So any thoughts on who that consensus candidate could be? I've had people go, no, it's going to be Hakeem Jeffries. I'm going, it's never going to be Hakeem Jeffries. Yeah. That is never going to happen. Stop with the fantasy.
I think that if Scalise and Jordan don't come close and can't get there, I could see the House rallying around Patrick McHenry, who's the interim speaker right now. I think he's third in leadership. Or keep your eyes on an old guy who's been there forever, Tom Cole out of Oklahoma. He's just a good old boy, a good, simple moderate. Whoever's going to be speaker, Rick, is going to be a caretaker. It doesn't matter who the speaker is, because the next year is going to be continued chaos, dysfunction, and incompetence, no matter who the speaker is.
Yeah, but we've got, I don't know if you've checked your calendar, but we got about 30 days. Mm-hmm. About 30 days until the next debt crisis puts the world on notice that we may default on some stuff. We may shut down the government. Who knows what we're going to do next? But we got about 30 days before Thanksgiving, and who knows if they kick it before Christmas, or who knows? Should have some functional leadership, don't you think?
Yes. But Rick, the party is dysfunctional. Donald Trump is the leader of the party. He's going to be the nominee. You almost could make an argument that it's no longer a political party. When it comes to the shutdown in 30 days, both Jordan and Scalise said today to their Republican colleagues, they're going to push another continuing resolution no matter what. So we're going to continue to do that, just live by continuing resolution. So I don't think that's going to be an issue. I'm more concerned about, like, Israel getting money and stuff to Israel right now.
Right.
And we can't do that without a speaker.
So, if we can't get any money to Israel, what does Biden do? And is it, I guess, let me ask you this. Is this Biden's fault? Is it all Biden's fault? I saw Fox News say that it was Biden's fault since, what was the quote? Couldn't get, what was this? Hold on, I'll find it. It couldn't get.
Who?
What's going on this attack on Israel is Biden's fault for not getting his people confirmed. It's Biden's fault for the lack of Senate confirmed elected officials was the exact quote, which is, I love Fox News. Love me some Fox News. Is it Biden's fault?
Not at all. Look, Rick, I am off the charts pro-Israel. When I was in Congress, I was the most pro-Israel member of Congress. Joe Biden has always been a good, loyal friend of Israel's. Man, Rick, I bet you heard his speech today.
I did.
That was one of the clearest, strongest expressions of support for Israel I've ever seen from an American president. I don't think Biden has been strong enough with Iran. But no, this isn't Biden's fault. This is Iran's fault. This is Russia's fault. This is Hamas's fault.
So, in moving forward, because, I saw Tim Scott's statement that, this is all Joe Biden's fault because, evidently we're weak.
No, Rick, it was even worse.
Hold on. I'm getting to it. He says that we need to return to strength.
No, I thought he said, yeah, Hamas did it. But Joe Biden has blood on his hands.
That was yesterday.
My God, what a despicable thing to say. You know what, Rick? I'm always blown away by all my former colleagues who sold their soul to Trump. I always thought, I never thought Tim Scott would. I went to Congress with him. I thought he was a decent guy. He sold his soul to Trump. That is one of the ugliest things I've ever heard a member of Congress say. Joe Biden has blood on his hands? That's just despicable.
But where I was getting to is, it sounds like a lot of our friends in the Republican Party are echoing, you're echoing what we hear from the legislature in Iran, from Vladimir Putin. It sounds like, I started today off by going, the people who hate America are attacking us again. And our Republican friends are doing it.
Isn't that funny? You're young. I'm an old fart, but you're young. But I know you've read about back in the day when the left was the blame America folk, right? I think Gene Kirkpatrick in the Reagan administration went after the left for always blaming America. You're right, Rick. Right now, it's my former party. It's the right that blames America for Russia invading Ukraine. And they're doing the same thing here. They blame America at every chance they can. This Tucker Carlson, J.D. Vance out of Ohio, some of the crap, I caught my language, I watched it, some of the crap J.D. Vance has been saying, blaming us for everything. What an ugly aspect of the right.
Yeah. No, and this is the thing that gets me, and they're throwing all this stuff out without any attempt to have a solution or a way forward. It's all attack, attack, attack. And look, how do we solve this problem? This has been going on my entire lifetime.
since Israel's founding, Rick, Israel has been surrounded by neighbors who do not believe Israel has a right to exist. Period.
Right.
Could you imagine, Rick Smith, living in a neighborhood? I know what your neighborhood's like. You probably have a big fancy house and you live in a neighborhood with a bunch of other big fancy houses. Imagine every one of your neighbors didn't believe you had a right to live. And in fact, they wrote up constitutions in their houses pledging to destroy you. That's what Israel's lived with for 75 years. You're never going to have peace with that. The only way you get peace in the Middle East is if you eradicate, I mean, get rid of the people who want to get rid of Israel. That means, Rick, Israel has to go into Gaza, and I mean wipe Hamas off the face of the earth. Period. And by the way, that's the best thing for the Palestinian people. Yeah, you're not buying any of what I just said. I can tell by the look on your face.
No, I understand it. I'm trying to see. Here's where I'm at, and I'll be quite frank. And I said this yesterday. I don't know enough about the situation to say what you've said. I understand that if you've got a situation where two parties can't get along, one of them's got to go. I get that. How much of Hamas is the Palestinian people? How much of this is intertwined? How much of it is? I don't know. I mean, you're the person who's the expert on this. Tell me, what don't we know?
Well, remember, Hamas is a terrorist organization, yep, and they happen to be the ruling government of Gaza. They're also extremely popular with Palestinians in the West Bank. But they're terrorists, and they haven't had an election since 2006. Maybe about half of the Palestinian people in Gaza support them, but the other half, they can't do anything. And part of the problem, Rick, is all of the other Arab countries use the Palestinians as a proxy to try to make life miserable for Israel. And we were just at a point where Trump started it and Biden's continued it, where some of the more moderate Arab countries were normalizing relationships with Israel. Iran wanted to stop that, which is why they had Hamas do what they did 3 days ago.
Okay, because look, you know, as I'm being told, look, you know, Gaza, the unemployment rate in the Gaza area is like 90% for 18.
It's gross. It's a mess.
And it's a mess on all sides. So, you know, you're saying go after Hamas, which, you know, I'm all for. You know, go after terrorists. Absolutely. If you're the problem, you go. I get that. But you know, what do you do with all of the
then what?
What do you
do
with
then what?
With all of the people who are desperate. When you have desperation and you have desperate conditions, desperate people do desperate things.
Right. So here's what should be done. Remember, in 2005, Israel gave Gaza back. Israel left Gaza and said, all right, Palestinians, it's yours. You run it. And then they picked Hamas and away we go. Israel's going to have to take Gaza back. And that's, by the way, what's going to happen. This is going to be ugly. They're going to take Hamas back. And then, you know what? They should turn to Egypt and Jordan and say, you take all these Palestinian people. And Israel, Rick, should then say, we're going to make Gaza part of Israel because, by the way, Rick, the Muslims and the Arabs who live in Israel right now are freer, happier, and more prosperous than Muslims and Arabs who live in any of their neighboring countries because they're freer in Israel. Israel's not perfect, but it's a democracy. So the Palestinians would be better off if Gaza was part of Israel. Man, look at you and I going down this road.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm listening to what you're saying. I'm absorbing
it. But that's a minority view. My view is a minority.
Yeah, no, I'm absorbing it. I'm not on board, but I'm absorbing it. I'm going to think about this because
we'll continue this.
No, because look, at some point there's got to be a way forward in this because it seems like this keeps happening, you know, every so often where an attack happens and then Israel responds overwhelmingly, which is going to happen. You're going to see massive death and destruction. And it's always the poor and the working class who suffer in all of this stuff. It's always the most desperate, the most at the margin people who struggle in this, and the people who are at the top who make the decisions, they walk away from it. It's like, that's where my frustration is.
I get it, and I hear it. Yeah. And I would just add one more thing. Hamas, the ruling government of all those poor people, has purposely, over the last 18 years, made their people miserable. They've taken all the money and used it for their terror activities. All the money that would have gone to jobs and hospitals and schools. Hamas is responsible for the conditions in Gaza. They need to be eliminated.
Yeah. So last question on this, I got for you. What do we do with this?
Well, Israel's our greatest ally on the planet, and so this. And by the way, Rick. I think Biden said today 14 known Americans have been killed and at least 10 Americans are being held hostage right now. Can you imagine a situation in a couple days where Hamas is parading American hostages through the streets of Gaza? This is our war too, period.
Well, we'll see. Joe, as always, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Hey, Rick, I watch my language. I love you.
I love the fact that you did. Thanks so much, Joe. Friend Joe Walsh. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break back with your thoughts after this. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Let's go to the phone lines. Got John in Los Angeles on line one. John, what's on your mind? How are you?
Hey, Rick. How are you? I'm okay. It sounds like you're friends with this Joe, what is his name, Walsh?
Yeah, Joe Walsh.
Yeah. A few years back, I had a friend, she's since died, I believe, but she was Jewish, and when we had a discussion, she had no concept that the one kibbutz that she had lived in for a while back was built on a town that was a Palestinian town, and it sounds like this guy has no concept of how Israel was formed. And it was just plopped down on top of a bunch of people, and they were squeezed out, forced out, pissed on, and pushed over. Now, you know, they act as if everything sprouted up with manifest destiny, like this country, but it didn't. It wasn't free. It wasn't easy, and it wasn't clean, this Israel. And when people wonder why the neighbors are angry, all the neighbors used to be the indigenous, who were squashed on and sat on and kicked over like bovine excrement. what do you expect? What does he expect?
Yeah,
too much.
You.
That's what I think.
No, I appreciate it, John. I appreciate the thoughts.
You have a nice day, Rick.
Thanks so much. No, I look, as I said from the beginning, you know, there's history here that goes well back before I was born. And there doesn't seem to be a pathway forward. And you know, people are dug in on their sides. And again, nobody's talking about solutions on how we fix this. And, you know, what I do know is every time there's one of these attacks, the response is, you know, overwhelming. The pain and the suffering is overwhelming. And then we dig in even deeper until the next time and the next time. I don't know the way forward. And I'm not pretending that I do. My point is it looks like, you know, here at home, again, this is another moment for our Republican Party to join in with the people who hate this country to attack us even more. But I appreciate the thoughts. Want to hear your thought? Email me, Rick at RickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1913. At 2:02 in the afternoon, President Woodrow Wilson at the White House touched off an explosion at the Gamboa Dike in Panama. With that touch of a button, the last barrier to joining the waters of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans through the Panama Canal went up in smoke. The Chicago Tribune described the scene in Panama writing, quote, "Then suddenly came the muffled roar of the discharge of 1,600 pounds of dynamite, which sent a shower of water, mud, and rock high into the air. Spreading out as it went upward, the hole heavily veiled into a cloud of smoke. As water began to pour through the rent made by the explosion, the crowd sent up a great cheer. It was a noteworthy moment in the construction of the canal, but that moment came at a staggering cost of workers' lives. For more than 20 years, the French and then the United States worked on the canal project. The U.S. phase lasted for a decade. As many as 45,000 workers toiled on the canal during the peak years of construction. These workers came from the United States, Europe, Asia, and Panama. West Indians formed the core of the work crews. These workers faced stifling heat, brutal working conditions, and poor accommodations. Workers had to contend with ravaging disease, poisonous snakes, and torrential rains. Workers also faced racial discrimination. For example, West Indian workers earned half the hourly wages of U.S. and European workers. They also lived in much more crowded barracks. Worker deaths were so frequent that death or funerary trains made continual runs to bring the bodies away from the construction site. It is estimated that more than 27,000 men died building the canal. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Over time, words with beautiful meanings occasionally get degraded into ugliness. Gentle, for example. Originally meaning good-natured and kindly, it was twisted into gentry in the Middle Ages by very ungentle land barons seeking a patina of refinement. Then it became a pretentious verb to gentrify, meaning to make something common appear upscale. And now the word has devolved to gentrification, describing the greed of developers and speculators who oust middle and low-income families from their communities to create trendy enclaves for the rich. The latest move by these profiteers is their meanest yet, targeting families with the most tenuous hold on affordable shelter, people living in mobile home parks. Some 20 million Americans, especially vulnerable senior citizens, veterans, the disabled, and immigrant workers, make their homes in these inexpensive parks. Well, inexpensive until the vultures sweep in, including multi-billion-dollar Wall Street powerhouses like Blackstone Group, Apollo Global Management, and Carlyle Group that are buying up hundreds of trailer parks across the country. These are easy for unprincipled speculators to grab. While tenants might own their mobile homes, they rent the lots, and the first sign that a huckster has taken over a neighborhood park is an unwarranted spike in everyone's rent. Residents are captive tenants, for these homes are not really mobile, and even if one can be moved, the cost can top $10,000. New Yorker magazine notes that today's typical mobile home park has been called a waffle house where customers are chained to their booths. Corporate predators are steadily driving out lower-income families, then remaking the parks to attract upscale owners of million-dollar mobile homes. This is Jim Hightower saying, and where do former tenants go? Away. Out of sight, out of mind.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday I talked about the Reuters report that pointed out, hey, the rich are getting richer, and everyone else, well, not so much. And look, shouldn't be shocked, shouldn't be surprised. And this is one of the things that I'm really concerned about the 2024 election, because, you know, I had lunch today with a friend who was saying, you know, hey, you know, things are hard. You know, the prices of everything have gone up. My wages haven't gone up enough. And the reality is corporate America, they're doing very well. Thank you very much. Shareholders are doing well. CEOs are doing well. Why do you think we're seeing all these strikes? Why do you think workers are finally saying I've had enough already? But here to share some thoughts on where we are. And again, inequality growing again. That's why I've asked our good friend Mateus Vernengo to come talk with us. Mateus is a professor at Bucknell University, one of my economic gurus. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you for having me, Rick. Always a pleasure to be here.
So what do you make of this latest bit of numbering that says, look, you know, things are going up. The top 1%, they're almost at the all-time high again. During the pandemic, actually reached the all-time high. What do you make of these numbers?
Not a surprise. I'm sorry to say, you know, this is to a great extent the fact that we couldn't pass some of the legislation that Biden wanted with the larger fiscal package, you know, the Build Back Better, you know, that ended up not passing in full. We did reduce poverty during the pandemic, actually, because some of those programs of helping people, you know, stay at home instead of being kicked out, of receiving enough money so that they can sort of, have food, that not having to pay college, debt that we're again paying, all of those things, more or less reduced some of the problems. At the beginning of the pandemic, real wages went up. Of course, as you said, from then on, we have, the price of oil went up, the snags in the supply chain, corporations, being able to take advantage of all of that. So prices went up, wages have sort of stagnated in comparison to the price of all of those things. So real wages are down, and we're back to the same patterns as before. We are cutting spending. We are again charged, people have to pay back their debts on college debt. Rents are going up through the roof, so that's one of the elements that kept inflation going a little bit further. Price of oil is again going up, all of those things. So it's the return to things as normal. And also, I should say, from this last year, the fact that Republicans won the narrowly, but won the House, gives them some room for doing things. I mean, we were very lucky that we didn't get a shutdown, but I'm not sure that's not going to happen, in November. I mean, it's not clear they're going to get a speaker. And all of that points to no extra fiscal spending. At the same time, the Fed has hiked interest rates, and interest rates higher, mortgages are higher, rents are higher. So this hits everybody very heavily. The middle class is sort of squeezed. So these are not new patterns, I'm sorry to say. It's not a surprise that inequality has gone up. And I should say this also has global implications. So there are many countries that are on the verge of severe financial crisis, because the Fed hiking interest rates is also puts all debtors. So if you have a mortgage, it's on flexible rates, your mortgage payments go up. If you are a developing country and the interest rate in the United States goes up, it's essentially the same thing. It's, you have to pay higher interest and hike your rates of interest so that, to avoid capital flight and whatnot. So this is a complicated situation for the world, let alone all the other geopolitical things that, So these are complicated times.
And the thing is, while it's bad here, The rest of the globe is experiencing, you know, things, you know, as bad, if not worse.
Oh, sure. As I was saying, I just came back from India, and I'm somewhat jet lagged, you know, it's a part of the world. Pakistan is one of the most, you know, India is exactly between Pakistan and Sri Lanka, two of the, you know, of the highest sort of indebted countries that are in significant problems. And yeah, we're talking of countries that, you know, really need to grow fast and catch up. And, you know, the levels of inequality and poverty in places like India are humongous. So there is a great disadvantage, so to speak. So what the United States does has global implications too. And so these pro-business, pro-corporation policies, which I think are to some extent favoring not just the elites in the United States, the corporations, the CEOs, as you were saying, in the United States, is also their equivalents, their pars in those developing countries. So it's the working class, both in the developing world and in America, that are suffering.
You know, it's obscene when you look at here, you know, the top 1% of households by income holding, you know, something almost 27% of the household wealth in this country. In other countries, it's actually much worse than that. But I mean, 27% held by the top 1% is obscene.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, this is Gilded Age sort of levels. I joke with my students, you know, I always ask them, you know, tell me the name of billionaires of the, you know, Gilded Age era. And I'm always glad that, you know, I'm always afraid that they're not going to know any history, but they can come up with names, you know, the Morgans and the Carnegies and the, you know, Rockefellers. And then I ask them, you know, tell me billionaires of now. And they all, you know, we have tons of billionaires, the Bezos, the, you know, Elon Musk's and, you know, and Zuckerberg's and so on and so forth. And then I asked them, tell me a billionaire, you know, millionaire, you know, iconic figure equivalent of the 50s and 60s. And there are none. And there are none because, you know, we tax them the hell out of them, 95%, you know, marginal tax rate. I should say the most creative answer that I got was one Hugh Hefner, but which, you know, I was impressed. That kid knew about Playboy. But you know, I says, no, dude, he was just a tiny millionaire. I mean, in comparison to all the other stuff, nothing. I mean, it's not like you're having to control the world. So if you were a teenage boy, perhaps, but not.
He had everything every teenage boy ever wanted.
Yes. But, you know, but there aren't. And, you know, that tells you something. You know, it's funny that economists call that the golden age of capitalism, that period. And I joke, I mean, one has to be careful because, you know, if you were, I always say, you know, if you were, you know, a woman or African-American in the United States, let alone in certain other parts of the world, we still have colonies at that point. But, you know, it was more difficult, no doubt. But, you know, it's called the golden age because wages were high. There was hope for the working class and so on and so forth. But, you know, that was sandwiched by two Gilded Ages. And we have essentially a world that it's not very different than the Gilded Age of, you know, the Rockefellers. And they're in charge. They're in charge in, you know, in Congress. So we do have data that shows that, you know, the vote of a billionaire, you know, counts more. I mean, they get the legislation they want. They got the Supreme Court they want. So that's the problem with wealth inequality. It's to what extent wealth inequality is compatible with the democratic society, with the ideals of the democratic society. And that's why I think, as you were saying, people are angry, people are not happy, you know, people think that this is unsustainable.
And this is why I think you're seeing a lot of strike activity and you're seeing a lot of workers who have had enough. Because, you know, we do know the history. You know, I think back to my grandparents' generation. They fought for better wages, hours, conditions, and they lived through a great era of prosperity. In fact, you know, I saw this great, you know, graph where they, you know, they had the, you know, the era of great prosperity from 47 to 79, and then the great regression from 1980 until now, of which, you know, in that prosperous era, you know, a meritocracy emerged
them, for example, just an example. This October, we were paying against college debt. And think of this, GI Bill, you know, they gave, fair enough, these people gave their blood, you know, but, you know, they gave free education, you know, so a whole generation that basically went to college for free, they made the middle class. So not only you got college for free, basically buying a house was heavily subsidized. So essentially the two things that make the bulk of what makes the middle class. So if you're middle class, if you have a house, it's where most of your savings are, and you have some sort of diploma and you have, your ability to go out and get a decent, there is still a gap between the wages of skilled, educated, college educated kids and workers unskilled without, a high school diploma. Those are very, sort of significant and persistent differences. And, if you are democratizing, you're allowing people to get that education, of course you make a difference. And so all of that has vanished. And I agree. I think that's the part that I like. I think that there is a positive anger. So the unions going out and negotiating and seeing more of these, United Auto Workers stopping, I think that that's a positive sign. I think that, hopefully, there is some hope that this model, is unsustainable and some change is needed. But of course, there is the fear. One has to remember in the 30s when, this sort of things happen, the two alternative models, Stalinism and fascism and the Nazis were out there and we had Father Coughlin and, those things in the United States, those things did exist. And we have Trump and, in the election, God knows what happens next year. It's not like it is a case closed and simple election, I should say in Brazil, at least, we had a year after actually January 6th in Brazil was January 8th, and a very similar thing. They invaded Congress. They tried a coup, and Bolsonaro, who was behind this, he's not in jail, but he is ineligible, so he cannot run for president in the next election. He cannot run until 2032, in which he will be really old. So the Brazilian judicial system acted promptly and made the connections of him being linked to this movement, and he cannot be elected. I'm sorry to say that didn't happen in our case here, and it's a real danger, and God knows what happens with a Trump presidency.
Yeah, but again, I come back to these numbers and this the economy that was, the economy that is, and the brave new world that can be. I hope we're in a transition period, because I'm hoping we've had enough of this. I'm hoping we've had enough of one guy taking 27% of the economy and shoving it in their pocket.
I think for certain things, certainly there has been a new. So the Biden administration has talked, Jake Sullivan, he's a foreign affairs, advisor, has, it's not the right name of the position, but, Jake Sullivan has talked about a new Washington consensus, and there are things that are important. So I think one is there has a consensus even with Republicans that, some degree of protection with regard to China is important thing, that some jobs, have to, manufacturing jobs including, have to come back to the United States. I don't think that many will, but some will. And the CHIPS Act is a testament to that. And so some of those are coming. Some of those actually creating problems, the fact that some of these electric cars and battery, are more, mechanized and require less workers and hurt, unions. So, some of these jobs are coming back. It has a preoccupation Biden. I don't think that that's a consensus. So Biden has a preoccupation with unions. He showed that at picket lines and whatnot. There is a consensus, I think, that industrial policy, all economists are talking now that industrial policy is necessary. And so that we need to be concerned with having key manufacturing jobs and sectors within the country and so on and so forth. That's a consensus. But the notion that goes with protecting unions, and I think that that's sincere and true in Biden. I'm not sure that is a consensus. So I don't think that even within the Democratic Party, that's a consensus. The Democratic Party still has a strong neoliberal, pro-business constituency. And the Republicans are just playing lip service to this kind of agenda. It is very much a corporate party. So that, I think, it's problematic that party is not completely there. So it is an agenda that puts at the center the American economy, but not necessarily American workers, for sure American corporations.
I know I ask this all the time, but you know, there's still talk of a potential recession down the road. I've heard, I know for some it's a fantasy. They're hoping, they're wishing, because it will hurt Biden. It'll hurt the Democrats in the election in 2024, and probably the only way Republicans maintain power in the House. Do we have still a fear of a potential recession, especially because, you know, wages are rising? I got people telling me, you know, those unions that are asking for those pay increases, they're going to cause a recession. Should we be concerned about that?
Not the unions, the wages. I mean, I wish they got, you know, the wage hikes. So the wage hikes and a little bit of inflation, actually a little bit of inflation, if comes out of that, good. So I don't care. Provided the wages, you know, sort of stay ahead of inflation, I have no problem with that. My fear of recession is not from the higher wages. My fear of recession is what the Fed will do. If the Fed keeps hiking rates of interest and they promise another hike, and if Republicans are playing with fire, and we know that they want to play with fire. So they want to see the whole thing. I mean, there is a group within the Republican Party that they want to see chaos. And so if they shut down the economy, and if the shutdown is prolonged enough, if the Fed hikes the rate of interest because of the fear, the last numbers in the labor market were again relatively strong, 300-something%. It has continued to be strong. So if they decide that they want to slow down the economy, remember Larry Summers, not a Republican, Larry Summers, Treasury Secretary of Bill Clinton, advisor to Obama, at least not inside the White House now with Biden, so outside, but an influential voice within the Democratic Party. He said that we needed, you know, at least 2 years of more than 5% of unemployment, or at least 1 year of more than 10% unemployment in order to control inflation for sure. So he's been asking the Fed to be more, you know, hawkish and hike the rate of interest even more. And so I'm afraid that it cannot be ruled out. It's one of the things that, you know, keeps me up at night, is the possibility of a recession. Having said that, you know, we've been talking, as you said, for a while about this, and you know, if the short shutdown, if the Fed, comes down and this is the last one of the hikes, and then they slowly start reducing the rate, maybe we do achieve the, you know, so-called soft landing. So it's not impossible. So we'll see. I mean, nobody has the, you know, crystal ball to know exactly what will happen. Economists very often, you know, get things wrong, and you know, I'm certainly no better than other economists at that. I do get things wrong all the time.
Well, we shall see. But as always, Mateus, I appreciate your input and your expertise. Good stuff.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much, our good friend Mateus Fernango. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1933. That was the day that 40 armed cotton growers shot at a group of striking workers in the small town of Pixley, California. That year, a wave of labor unrest had swept through the fields of California's agricultural industry. Nearly 50,000 workers participated in strikes throughout the year. The Agricultural Workers Industrial Union led many of the strikes. The American Federation of Labor also led two walkouts. Workers were angry over declining wages and the harsh working conditions of agricultural life. The Depression had slashed wages. Cotton field workers in the San Joaquin Valley had seen their wages cut by as much as 75%. Three-quarters of those workers were Mexican. As cotton harvest season neared, the workers organized to strike. They demanded a dollar for every 100 pounds of cotton they picked, and recognition of their union. The growers offered 60 cents. At the peak of the strike, an estimated 12,000 to 18,000 workers had walked off the job. Anger mounted. Armed growers attacked striking workers, demanding they return to work or leave California. Strike leaders were arrested. In Pixley, the growers formed a Farmers Protective Association. They claimed to have as many as 600 members. Reportedly, one manager of a cotton gin told the farmers, "The time has come for us to take the law into our own hands and drive the strikers from our farms." The simmering tensions boiled over. As highway patrolmen looked on, gun, a band of growers shot into a group of unarmed strikers. At least two strikers fell dead. The violence resulted in public outcry and federal intervention. The workers received federal relief, and a mediator helped to settle the strike. And in the settlement, the workers would receive 75 cents per 100 pounds of cotton. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Check out our website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So on Thursday, you've got the culinary workers who are going to hit the picket line at MGM Resorts and Caesars Entertainment Casinos in Las Vegas. Thousands of workers are going to take to the streets as part of this massive, what was it, 50,000 plus hospitality workers in Las Vegas who are, fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, saying, hey, look, we earn a reasonable living. We earn these companies massive, massive profits. I don't like the word deserve, because that sounds like almost like an entitlement. Oh, we deserve this. No, they earn this money. They earn every penny of it and then some. These casinos, wildly profitable. And then again, across the board, I mean, you look at the fact, the distribution of income in this country, when 1% of the people in this country are pocketing almost 27% of what's created, there's a problem here. And you fix that with a tax code. It's what we did in the old days. And I love the way Mateus pointed out, tell me the Gilded Age, the robber barons. And people could do that. Tell me today's robber barons. And people can do that. Point to the 50s. Who was the billionaire of that? Oh, wait a minute. There wasn't. There were rich people. There were rich people, trust me. But there were no gazillionaires. Cause we, as a matter of policy, taxed them, massive estate tax, income tax, a top marginal tax rate of 92%, a corporate tax of 56%. And then you had this thing, it's people who are paying those taxes. Yeah, working people are paying those taxes. But understand, if you want me to buy your product, it's got to be competitively priced, which means you're going to take less profit. That's how that works. We're in a moment right now where it's maximum profits. We're going to line our pockets with as much as we can get. Hooray for us and screw those working people. So it's good to see folks in the streets. Thrilled with it. Absolutely thrilled. Interesting news coming out of New York. George Santos has been charged with... What was it, 23 counts of this massive indictment, a superseding indictment is what they've called it. One count of conspiracy to commit offenses against the United States, two counts of wire fraud, two counts of making materially false statements to the FEC, two counts of falsifying records submitted to obstruct the FEC, two counts of aggravated identity theft, and one count of access device fraud. Basically, what he was doing is he was anybody who had given him money as a campaign contribution, he just kept charging him and charging him and charging him, even when it went beyond the FEC's individual contribution limits. Just kept churning and just kept basically stealing from people. He's now been charged with this 23-count indictment, and we'll see what happens. They point on one occasion, Santos charged $12,000 to the contributor's card, ultimately transferring the money to his personal account, which is a no-no. It's a no-no. You can't do that. And I find it interesting that now is when they've decided to do this. This doesn't seem like it should have taken this long, but here we are. And finally, remember Don Blankenship? He was the guy who was the head of the coal mine, you know, back in 2010, they had a mine disaster in West Virginia that killed 29 miners. He was convicted of a misdemeanor related to that. Well, he tried to sue news organizations who said it was a felony, you know, for defamation and all kinds of stuff. Well, the Supreme Court threw that all out. They declined to consider overturning the landmark case that gives news organizations a little bit of protection. And couldn't be a nicer guy. This is the guy who said, you know, we don't get paid to put up safety precautions. We get paid to run coal. You know, so your safety and the safety of working people be damned. It's about the money in his pocket. Now, he's not going to suffer from black lung.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.